Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show, already the third show of 2022. It's still cold and dry, so there is much more of that high value slurry on the move. Shout out to our supporters, Grassland Agro and Dairy Master, for helping us to make this show happen. Later in the show, we'll be joined by David Corbett from Grassland Agro to discuss some of the ongoing fertilizer issues. As normal, to start, I've quick first questions for Adam, Darren and Aidan. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk@farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 086-836-6465. Thanks to those that have sent in questions. Adam, I've two quick ones for you in terms of quick fire. The first one, I think, is more of a comment, and it's from the same farmer that sent in about the query about the bull beef last week. He obviously was watching and didn't like your reply to him. Don't agree with Adam on the bull beef. The dairy branding and breeding is all around a grass-based system. Beef breeders need to get their act together and find the genetics that will finish off grass at a young age, just like the dairy industry did with breeding cows for a grass system in the last 30 years. And that's how we need to brand the model and beef industry around and showcase the health and environmental benefits of a grass-based system. Beefside more occupied with the show ring. Adam, he's not entirely agreeing with you, but that's more a comment. I don't see a question in it.
I know. Yeah. Valid points, I suppose, made. We can't argue with the science, though, Jack. If we go back to science, let science do the arguing for us. We had it in the paper last week that you know, bulls are more carbon efficient than steers, and they're more profitable than steers as well. And that's Chugga's research, and that's been backed up again in this week's paper. And I guess on the genetics, getting our act together, using the right genetics, unfortunately, we're not in control of a lot of the genetics that we get from the dairy herd in terms of finishing our beef cattle on beef farms. And more cattle are coming from the dairy herd. So I guess maybe it's a two-way approach that we need. But yeah, no, valid points, but I'm still sticking to my bulls as being more carbon efficient and more profitable.
Okay, nice one. Most of those dairy stock will finish long before 20 months, Adam, won't they? That won't be a problem. But anyway, we'll come back to that again. Second quick fire for you, Adam. Going around March since Christmas, one wonders how factory agents can give €3 a kilo and sometimes more, which would equate to €5 a kilo dead, and don't give the same to farmers going directly to the factory. And also, should these high prices be reflected on the journal average beef price chart? And if not, why not? Strong comment, question, Adam.
I'm getting that, Jack, all the way. And I suppose, put it very simply, Jack, if a factory's killing 500 cattle a week and they're buying 50 of those in a mart, they can do that very quietly and not too many knows, I guess, what they're paying for those. Whereas if they raise the quotes for cull cows up to 440 a kilo, well, everybody in the country will know that factory is paying 440 a kilo. So then they have to buy 500 cattle for the week at 440 a kilo, as opposed to buying just 50 of those cattle in the mart. And I'd love to get the, I suppose, under the bonnet of that in terms of what prices are being paid for in the marts, but we can just go in terms of what we see in marts and what we are, look at market intelligence around the country. There is no price reporting of those cattle. Those cattle are killed and we get the price back through the Department of Agriculture, and that's the way it works.
That's the model that's there. And as you say, you are keeping a tight eye on mart information and mart bids, and that gives you some of a steer, but it's not categorical, as you say, and you don't know when the factory is going to get them. Okay, nice one. Thanks, Adam. Back to you in a minute. Darren, looking at you, two quick fires again in here for you. According to a Sullivan & Co. 2023 update on leasing land, farmers can lease land and entitlements and are safe until the end of the forthcoming scheme 2027. Is this in legislation and no talk about proof of being a full-time farmer? Thanks and really enjoy the show. Best regards, Aidan. So let me just get this straight, Darren. I mean, he's quoting O'Sullivan & Co., which I presume maybe is a consultant. Up there, they have an update on leasing land, and they're saying that farmers can lease land and entitlements and are safe until the end of the forthcoming scheme 2027. Is this in legislation, and there's no talk about being a full-time farmer? So there's two kind of pieces there. One is the leasing, Darren, and the other piece is the full-time farmer or active farmer type query. Like, just give us what we know on those as it stands now.
Yeah, I'd probably go back and see what he means by safe as well, Jack. I might get in contact with that farm after. But from what I see, it is, look, yeah, of course, you can continue to lease out your entitlements. There's no change at all on that. Farmers that have entered into long-term leases, 10 or 15 years, they can lease out the entitlements unless the department bring in something that changes the entitlements reverting back to the landowner. Now, there's nothing at all to state or to say that might happen at the moment or to suggest that. The second part of the question was around, say, the 2023-2027 part. Yes, look, there is no change there, Jack. Look, it is what it is, but maybe we'll explore. I get in contact with the farmer just around the safe farm and that report just to see exactly what's mentioned. Yeah.
Okay, and I mean, as you say, that's the new scheme that he's talking about, the next 4 years, the 2023, not 2022 that we're in, it's the 23 to 27 scheme he's talking about. And the active farmer or the full-time farmer piece, but the proof of being a full-time farmer, again, no more detail on that, Darren, is there?
No more detail, but say, if I take it from a leasing, say, side there, that farmer, say, if a farmer's leasing out all these entitlements, he doesn't have to be a full-time farmer. So I'm presuming it's coming from that side of things. We did see some farmers in the last round maintaining it there just to say that they would be an active farmer or that they had some link to farm. I presume it's coming from that side. But no, equally, there's no more definition around the exact definition of what's going forward.
Okay. Okay, we'll probably come back to it, Darren. Second quick fire for you. Enjoy the report on the sale with yours with lambs at foot, as I'm hoping to sell some in the next few weeks. Photos are small, so maybe I'm wrong. Were the lambs tagged or do they need to be for sales now? So this was a sale, obviously, Darren, you reported on yours with lambs at foot, and this farmer is asking, he or she is asking, were the lambs tagged or do they need to be?
Yeah, I was actually at the sale, Jack, myself. I was down there on Tuesday. So look, I can state that there was two or three pins. I think they came in late. Lambs weren't tagged, but I seen fellas busy tagging them, busy tagging out in the yard. So I did. So look, I think that they were covered on that. There was just something that came in on the phone. I don't know whether you've seen it there, but it was something around a question around FBD sponsoring Simple Stadium, and is that an insurance policy for the Kerry and Tipperary hurling? Or maybe you're going to Aidan on that. Look, I you might have been there.
I'll hold that one for Aidan. You didn't do too great yourself at the weekend there, Darren. Bet you handsomely. No, it's early days, Darren. It's not even the league. Okay, nice one. So lambs, they need to be tagged. Aidan, two quick fires in here for you. I'm feeding calves twice a day while they are young, but milking once a day. How do lads manage if feeding calves warm milk in the evening? Okay, so it's early season feeding and calving and milking, Aidan. And so this guy is milking once a day to manage the workload, I suppose, and to give cows a chance. And he's feeding calves twice a day at the moment. Feeding warm milk in the evening, how he or she should do it.
Yeah, Jack, well, for me, like, if you're on the once a day job, I'd be quite happy to feed the calves cold milk. So, you know, obviously you're going to have the milk left over in the morning. It's a big job having to heat all that now in the afternoon again, whether you want to warm it through those heaters or, you know, whatever put into buckets of warm water. Like, it's a massive job. So for me, I'd say they're better off to stick with cold milk for the older calves. Now, obviously, newborn calves will need warm colostrum. And if you're training calves, you know, a day old or 2 days old to the teat, like, they need probably warm milk as well. So it's easy to heat up the small bit of milk. But for any other calves, I'd be quite happy to feed them cold milk morning and evening. Keep it consistent and keep it simple.
Okay. Nice one. Second question, is Aidan a fan of once-a-day milking? Surely in a high milk price year, more litres will pay. Talk to me, Aidan. We were talking about once a day last week.
Yeah, well, we're talking about once a day as a strategy in spring, I think, to reduce the workload, as you've alluded to earlier on. Look, we need to weigh up the extra time involved in milking in the evening versus the lost output that you could get if you milk twice a day and sold that extra litres. But remember now, it's in a small proportion. If you're doing it for 3 or 4 weeks in February, it's a small enough proportion of cows that are going to be milked once a day anyway. And over the course of lactation, Chagas research has found it made no impact or no significant impact. So we're all for litres and we're all for getting milk out the gate and money in the bank. But at the end of the day, it's not going to make much odds.
Okay, nice one. Thanks, Aidan. We'll probably touch off it again later on. Adam, looking at you for the main show, just talk to me about one of the big pieces, I suppose, that came on the horizon in the last week was Larry's new bonus, the new ABP 20 cents a kilo bonus for beef cattle. Talk to me in terms of first for farmers that haven't kind of heard much about it. Give me some of the detail and kind of then again kind of tell me what's in it for the factories and what's in it for the farmer.
Yeah, I guess look at the headline figure is the 20 cent, Jack. It's across suckler cattle and dairy cattle. No Jerseys in it, I would say that the limit is 12.5% Jerseys, so any of those extreme breeds are out. It's all of life quality assured, so there's a maximum of 2 farm residencies within the programs here. So you have to buy the calf off a farm, and then that's the 2 residencies, and it's all of life quality assured. So that first farm has to be quality assured as well. It's on top of the quality assurance bonus, and it's on top of a breed bonus. I suppose the base price will be the average of the 7 ABP or Slaney Foods price during the week. The big one is, the bid that's causing a bit of issues out there is the 12-month retention period on the finisher farm. So
basically, you have to hold that animal on the final farm for 12 months before it's slaughtered. So that's taken out a lot of traders, and it's taken out a lot of summer grazers, and there's a lot of irate farmers out there, but that, to be honest. And the other big one is the age of slaughter. I guess there's age limits there for slaughter, 26 months for suckler bred heifers, 24 months for dairy bred heifers, and 28 months for suckler bred steers, and 26 months for dairy bred steers. So really, you're talking for those dairy bred heifers, the limit is coming out of the shed, and really for the dairy bred steers is probably coming out of the shed as well, as at 26 months as well. So it's maybe pushing some of that back into a winter finishing system, and look at the money isn't good for that winter finishing. I guess from the factory's point of view, look at this is a great story to tell supermarkets that we're working in close conjunction with farmers, and we're worried about sustainability and we're concerned about sustainability, and that's why we're implementing this program. It also gives them great foresight to supply, I guess, in terms of these cattle will be booked in with ABP, so they will know exactly what cattle is coming online with them. They'll have liaison officers out on the ground. They'll be feeding back to the factory as to what cattle are coming. So I guess that's what it is. In terms of Keepac, would have launched their scheme in 2015. They had targets, I think, of 50,000 animals by 2021. I understand that it's a lot less than that actually went through the system in 2021. But I guess it's your standard integrated beef scheme in terms of partnership. But there's no co-op involved in this. Of course, Glanbia were involved in the Keepac one. There's no co-op. They've talked about, I suppose, working closely with dairy farmers in terms of using genetics. There is genetic indexes in it as well. I think the minimum, we'll say, sub-beef index on the dairy beef index is €35. On the dairy side, it's €100 on the suckler side. So there's different little bits and pieces. You have to be part of an environmental program or a biodiversity scheme like GLOS or BDGP or BeefS or the dairy beef program. So there's a lot of different little hoops to jump through as part of it, and then you get that 20 cent at the end. If it grades a P plus or better, and it grades between a 2 plus and a 4 plus on a fat score, there are carcass limits as well. And look, at the big one is bulls. We'll go back to bulls again. We're never going to get away from bulls, Jack, but bulls, 10% of your cattle that you slaughter as part of that program, it can't be over 10% as regards bulls. So really they're sending out a clear message that ABP don't want bulls, or don't want a lot of bulls as part of this program.
Yeah, Larry doesn't want the bulls. Okay. And Adam, I mean, in terms of we call it the real good suckler type cattle, we call it beef bred animals, we'll say the 28 months for steers, will that be, will there be much kickback from farmers in relation to that? Because I mean, a lot of those go for maybe the like we talked about last week, the second summer or third summer at grass, you know what I mean? And finished off grass, like maybe just under 30 months. Will they be able to squeeze in under the 28? Like we'll say, will that shove up the cost, we'll say, for those farmers?
I think it'll definitely show up the cost. I guess a continental animal, you know, people have been used to heading out to that 30 months and you're heading sort of off grass at that stage, you know, off that 30 months. So I think it can be done. And if you tweak the system, you definitely pull it back within that 2 months, and you'll probably come in maybe with a lighter sort of a carcass, but your carcass limit within that scheme is 400 kilos for your suckler steer anyway. So it's not going to make sense to push on for a heavier carcass weight, because you're going to lose that 20 cent then if you go over that 400 kilos. So I don't think it's a big one. The big one for me would be the 12 months retention period, and the big one would be the bulls as well, that it's only 10% bulls allowed in that scheme. You know, in terms of a sustainability program, again, it's quite ironic that the research says that bulls are one of the most carbon efficient animals we can do, and yet they're not included here.
Like, there's a real piece there around what you're talking about, the bull beef and the whole sustainability piece, and what the factories and the markets are saying. They're really not tallying. Sure, they're not, Adam. Like, they're not on the same wavelength, we'll say, at the moment, in terms of kind of what's kind of out there and linked into kind of what's happening on farms.
No, and excuse the pun, but like, a bad taste of bulls goes back to 13 or 14. And just to put it clear, Aidan Maloney has, in Chagas Grange, has said there's very little difference between eating quality of bulls and steers. But people got a real stinging back in 13 or 14, Jack, when the thing went wrong. And we'll say a lot of people got left with bulls and taken a lot less money in 14, whereas maybe 13 was a really, really good year for bulls. And that we'll say, memory is in the back of a lot of people's minds as regards bulls. But I think we need to move on from that, and we need to maybe educate the consumer. Like, how many consumers that are buying beef every week understand that bull beef is actually 32% more carbon efficient than steer beef? And if they were told that, why isn't the Green Party jumping up and down about this, Jack, in terms of why isn't the Green Party looking for us to move to bulls? I suppose we have this idea of grass-based systems being the most, you know, carbon efficient, but here we have the research showing that because we're reducing the slaughter age of the animal, we're actually really decreasing the carbon footprint of that animal. So but I think we need to look at it, and we will be looking at more in the next couple of weeks in the paper.
And Adam, just to finish on it, like, I mean, is there a tweak to the system to get more grass into those young bulls, we'll say, rather than take on the higher concentrate input piece? Like, is there a tweak to the system that potentially might work?
And there probably is, Jack, and that's probably back to silage quality, in terms of you have some guys down the south in particular, you know, working with really top quality silage, possibly even red clover silage, to drive on those bulls at a low concentrate level for that, you know, first part of the winter, and then move on to your ration then. And look, we're in the process of changing over to that Irish ration, in that's always the kickback that you get in terms of importing soya from South America in terms of into a bull diet. But we're going to be able to show this year that we actually don't need that we'll be able to do it on an Irish ration in terms of finishing those bulls. So that hammers that argument straight away. And yeah, silage quality, Jack, is probably that round bale silage going into those weanings to try and reduce the amount of concentrates going into them.
Okay, nice one. Adam, my local shopkeeper, he has a post office as well, and he also has a pub. He took last year off to go sailing around the world, and he ran out of water, wind and food down around the Rock of Gibraltar. You have two boats sailing around the Rock of Gibraltar at the moment.
Yes, they're currently steaming quite Titanic-esque around the West Mediterranean at the moment, and they're on their way for two load of Frisian bulls, basically 2,000 bulls apiece. They'll put on a northern based exporter is going to load out of Green Ore, and a southern based exporter is going to load out of Fines in County Limerick. They've been assembling them quite quickly over the last couple of weeks, paying somewhere around 160, 170 a kilo, between 300 and 500 kilos. And look, it's a positive to see them going. I know Mark Zieg on the Borbia job last week said that there was some good interest coming from Morocco, Israel and Libya actually at the moment in terms of cattle. So there is some confidence there that, that those boats will be turning when they hit Libya or hit Maserati over there, and they'll be turning and coming back again. And hopefully, I suppose getting them now is the thing, I guess. Frisian bulls, 300 to 500 kilos, and we're getting close to the Bordizzo coming out for some of them in terms of this time of the year. So, yeah, no, it's still a positive. Libya done something like 7,000 bulls last year. They've done 13,000 in 2020. And I know, speaking to Borbia, they are hopeful maybe that it will get back up to that 13,000 in 2022. And look, it's a good start to see 4,000 gone by the end of January.
Okay, nice one. Last one, Adam, for you. The slurry job, like, is there many of your guys going out with a taste of it at this stage? Are they holding tough?
Yeah, a lot of tankers moving actually up this country, Jack, but it's actually not slurry going out of farms, it's slurry coming into farms, would you believe? A lot of pig slurry moving. The word on the ground up here is that when ground conditions improve, pig slurry, you'll start paying for pig slurry. Up at home in Cavan and Monaghan and Leitrim and Longford, you get pig slurry to take it. You know, every other year you get it free of charge during the summer. And as I said, the thinking is that this year we'll have to pay for it. And that could be up at maybe 150 euros for a 3,000 gallon load of slurry. So the Cuto boys in my area are topping up their tanks at the moment to have it ready whenever they need it, maybe in terms of March and April time, maybe going out on silage ground and stuff like that. I know Mark Plunkett, I spoke to him during the week, and he was saying maybe in terms of maybe delaying a little bit in terms of soil temperatures to make sure that you're getting the full kick out of that slurry, that maybe if grass was growing and your soil temperature up 5-6 degrees, you'll get the full kick out of that. So maybe a little bit more delayed this year than maybe than other years as regards slurry application.
Nice one. Exactly. And we talk to David Corbett later on that a little bit more. Adam, rock and roll. Thanks for that. Chat to you next week. Darren, on your side of the house, like, I mean, ground is drying up again, I suppose, for a lot of your guys. I mean, most of the sheep probably have most of the grass gone at this stage, have they? Like, you know, what are your guys doing on fertilizer?
Yeah, Jack, and it even take a bit of Aidan. Aidan had problems last with heavy covers. A farmer texted me when he was watching Tech Talks and said, if Aidan needs a few yards, he said, to get out his slurry, he said, send them our way. So I suppose on fellas that would have grass maybe closed up in time or for early lambing, there has been a nice bit of growth over the winter, and it's about safeguarding that now and utilising it best. And like, there wouldn't be a lot of sheep farmers per se going with slurry on a sheep only, but there'd be a lot of mixed farmers, I suppose, maybe starting to go with a small bit, just maybe to bring down the pressure on tanks. But where your sheep are located, Jack, like, just 70-80% of them are in areas the ground is only really, I suppose, maybe starting to dry now to get out. And like, there's a lot of talk at the moment around fertilizer and should you go to fertilizer. Even Siobhan had a webinar last week with the sustainability or the footprint farmers, and we were talking a bit on that. And like, I think, Jack, there's a real, I suppose, maybe you need to nearly put farmers into two sort of categories, in that you have some very highly stocked farmers who are doing a lot of reseeding. P's and K's are good, regular lime applications, and they will get a very good kick from fertilizer. And they have no other option. It's a bit like, I suppose, the dairy side of things. And Aidan talked about it last week. They're into a system where they need grass and they have to go with fertilizer. Now, they'll probably push it back a bit from when they generally go. There won't be as many putting it out early. They might be going with a lower allocation on the first side of things. And some of them, I've also had a few calls recently that sort of looking at maybe conserving grass a bit, feeding a bit of meals for the first few weeks. And like, the animals where you're looking at there is your older animals or your younger animals that will get the greatest benefit from it, that you'll get a kick from, I suppose, maybe putting concentrates into the yaws and lamb performance, whereas maybe your yaws, say, that are sort of your, I suppose, maybe 2, 3, 4 year old yaws, they'll probably get away without it. And then you have your other cohort of farmers where I think early fertilizer applications is questionable, where they're on very marginal ground. The pH is an issue. So you're looking at the utilization or the how much of that fertilizer is going to be picked up. Yeah. Like, and there was a lot of talk, Jack, this year about fertilizer, and it could have been costing €1,000 last year. Yeah. Does that mean that for fellas paying 700-800 euros for a ton, that it might be costing them 1,500-1,600 euros. And in that situation, it's hard to argue against delaying and maybe bringing meal in a bit as well.
Yeah, no, you're right. Especially on those marginal land, especially, you know, with trafficability or getting out to graze and utilise it is going to be a problem as well. Like, Darren, was it Seamus McManaman said from Borbia that the sheep prices were going to stay rock and rolling all through 2022? What happened in markets this week?
Yeah, look, I was talking to Seamus yesterday, Jack, and look, isn't it a true sign of when you put something in the paper the 1 week or it's under pressure? Now, I suppose to give it a bit of a caveat, Seamus did say that there would be a lot of fluctuation or maybe variability in January. And we see that more so and quicker when we're coming off a high price in that you can get that volatility kicking into a market very quick. Now, there's a couple of things at play at the moment. Demand has maybe eased a small bit, as it does in January. We always see that. I think myself, this probably it's feeding into the factory's hands in this. They can slow up demand or slow up processing at a time when they're struggling to cope with COVID in some plants. Now, that's not across every plant, but there is plants where there is a lot of issues, and particularly in born and out lambs. And it's just maybe giving them time to maybe back up sheep or say to maybe, I suppose, maybe get control of the market and bring it back. Now, they're blaming that there is a lot of, say, challenges at the price and export markets. Next week, I think, Jack, we need to come back on this because we need to look at, well, if the prices are falling at the rate that they are in Ireland, well, then they should also be falling in France, in Spain, in the UK. So we need to get a handle around that and see where prices are and have they come back to the same extent. Okay. There is no doubt that there has been a bit of pressure in export markets. How long that last Jack depends on, I suppose, what way numbers come on. Like there isn't a big amount of numbers in the market, but yet last week's kill was 52,000 head. So numbers, I suppose, trickling along despite, I suppose, all them issues. And like for me, Jack, the big story this week is around penalties that factories are bringing in on carcass weights or what they deem to be overweight carcass weights.
Right, and are they getting serious with the 22 and 23 kilos there?
Sure they are, Jack. Now look, at the moment they're talking about 25 kilos, and any lamb over 25 kilos, like we mentioned last week, Kildare were topping them at 150. They're now topping them this week at 140, or that's what they're say putting in for a lamb over 25 kilos. The two Irish country meats plants in Camolin and Navan are talking about a 30 cent a kilo cut for lamb carcasses over 25 kilos. And part of it, I suppose, is coming from maybe fellas buying in stores at a higher price or specialist finishers and maybe trying to hold to get the most out of the market. Lambs killing maybe fairly well are being backed up at the moment. And for me, the area where it's maybe a bit unfair is that if there is being delays in processing or in killing at the moment, and if that does ring true for the next week or 2 weeks, well, then farmers can't be expected to take, say, all of the penalty there or the price penalty. Yes, I have no doubt that there is no excuse for, and factories will say that they're getting some consignments of lambs or hoggets, whatever you want to call them, this time of the year, coming in and killing 27, 28 kilos. There's no excuse for that. Like, but where a small percentage of lambs might have gone for 23 kilos up, killed out better, well, then we have to work our way through that over the next couple of weeks.
Okay. So, right, as you say, I mean, if feed price is where it is, Darren, and if you're anywhere knocking around that, you know, a carcass coming in at 23, 24 kilos, you'd be moving, like.
You would, like, Jackie, you would, like, no. And that's not to sort of frighten anyone into a genie having to move quicker, because that's the last thing you want either. And look, at Sean Dinney summed it up this week, is that farmers probably need to weigh their lambs a bit more often now, look at kill outs, look at the feeding regime, because the one thing that will turn this is that if there isn't a glut of lambs onto the market, but also we do need orderly, say, drafting them heavier lambs to keep them going through the system, because what that's doing at the moment is if they need boarding and out, they're falling out of the carcass market, they're creating a glut in the system, while at the same time there might be a bit of scope to keep lighter lambs on if trying to have orderly market and trying and bring a bit of balance back on the side of farmers.
Okay. Last one, Darren, for you. There's a little story there on the inside back page about, I suppose, those slurry spreading and those in vulnerable soils. And look at they've always been the ones, we'll say, that are, I suppose, there's most eyes watching them, you know, in terms of there's obviously a lot more leaching going on in vulnerable soils, and maybe they're in a more intensive area in terms of livestock. But there's a small story there that there's going to be more inspections in those vulnerable soil areas, we'll say, especially for slurry spreading. Like, talk to me about kind of what happens there. Who's going to do the inspections, Darren, and or who's liable to do the inspections, or who could do the inspections?
Yeah, I suppose it's not fully clear. Look, a colleague of ours, Noel Barden, was on a webinar, I think it was, saying, and was the Department of Housing who look after or who are linked into nitrates and slurry, and the Department of Agriculture. And there was a couple of bits around it in the saying there could be more inspections around sort of the soil water in the areas. And look, Jack, that's inevitable. I think that there's so much pressure around water quality at the moment, is you will see more of that. And we do see DPA putting out reports every year, farmers coming into the firing line for them. Look, we can argue all we want about sewage plants and different bits going directly into rivers. For me, we have to look after our own ship as well. Like, yes, that is a travesty and that needs, but we do need to, I suppose, maybe look at slurry spreading dates. I suppose, look, it's like what Aidan was saying last week, he's probably going to touch on it, getting more out of slurry, not seeing it as a byproduct, seeing it as more value. For me, like, if that doesn't come under control in them areas, you will see a bit more, I think, maybe restrictions coming in the next nitrogen action plan around maybe stocking rates or slurry spreading dates or more of them inspections. Sorry, Jack, I didn't answer your question. Who can do the inspections? The Department of Agriculture are usually the ones, but the county council can also do inspections on, say, slurry spreading, water quality, and they link across with EPA.
Okay. But look, I think we've called it out before. We don't want bad practice on any farm, as you say. We have to look after our own ship as well. So look at it. It's, I suppose, it's a warning that there are more eyes on spreading nutrients at the moment, especially at these time of the year. Darren, 100% leave it at that for this week. We'll chat again next week. Aidan, with a question came in for you, and it was a quick fire, but I've kept it for a kind of a question now, because, you know, there's a good bit in it. I might read it out and get your thoughts on it. I'm a new entrant to dairy, and following the Chagas model the last 2 years and calving the most of my cows in 6 to 7 weeks, but seriously questioning it now, given the pressure is putting on space and work in trying to clean pens, give colostrum to calves, etc. So he's under pressure, all calving in 6 to 7 weeks, good fertility, etc. And he's obviously tight enough on kind of, I call it, facilities around calving, etc. I have 130 cows. How many calving pens should I have? And how do farmers feed enough colostrum to calves and get all the other jobs done? There is only so many hours in the day. Talk to me, Aidan. Like, it sounds like a farmer, he or she that's in, you know, he or she is under a bit of pressure at the moment. I suppose, you know, it's a bit getting to be busy time on a lot of your farms.
Yeah, Jack, and probably the number of cows involved is probably a crunch point there. You know, right? Probably not enough to have an extra labour unit, or maybe that extra labour unit isn't available, and maybe too much to do it all on your own as well. So it's in a difficult position. That 120, 130 cows, and if you go for 100 cows, really up to 130, 140, it's a difficult position really to be in. So I can see exactly where it's coming from. Like, I'd be very cautious to move away from that system, because what you end up finding if you go for spread out calving patterns, is that, you know, you're actually going to be working harder for longer. Now, except that it's very busy, you know, let's call him a he, it's very busy during that period. But once it's over, it's over. And then you have a break, and then you're into breeding, which is also busy. And then that's over. You have a very handy summer then, you'd say. And, you know, it's a relatively handy system until next spring again. So that's one side of it. But, like, you do need good facilities in order to run that system well and run it on your own or with small labour input. And, like, that's a given. I mean, he's asked how many calving pens he wants. Look, for 130 cows, I'd say it's a minimum of four, but better again to have five. But what's really better in that situation is to have a big open shed. You can let in 20, 30 cows and bed them on straw and let them do what they want. You know, let them calve, they calve. leave a little corner for handling them, you know, with a calving gate or whatever, that'll make life so much easier because you're not watching cows to see that. To take them out of the cubicle shed, to put them into those three or four pens that you might have. Okay, look, some people would say it's not good enough from a safety or, you know, or animal welfare point of view, and I should say about health, and, you know, that there could be cross-mothering and, you know, yones and all the rest. And they're all valid arguments as well. But, like, at the end of the day, this man is questioning his old system. So really, if you mean the communal calving area for me is the way to go in that situation. Obviously, you know, you can manage the risks, the other risks outside of that.
And Aidan, in a lot of cases, you know, that communal calving area, I'll say, it can be cleaned out more regularly with a tractor and loader rather than potentially kind of a lot more kind of barrow work and forking with kind of individual calf pens. Like, you know, so kind of, you know, there's a kind of an argument there that, listen, it can be cleaner as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely, Jack. You can go in there once a week or even more regularly and clean it all out with the tractor and for the loader and put a bed for straw on it. It's much harder to do that with smaller calving pens. As you say, it's kind of wheelbarrow work a lot of the time, or it's just not done and you're, you know, then there's a big buildup of straw on it. And then you're causing, you know, cows get E. coli mastitis and all these other problems. And, you know, you're fighting fires and at that stage, and that's what happens, you know. So definitely facilities. I mean, you can't, like, I'm not saying spend a fortune on these things, but there is some level of investment that's absolutely required in these situations. And you just have to go and do it. It's like, I mean, milk price is reasonably good. These are things that you'd be investing in that's going to future-proof your future farming career, make it much easier. And look, you don't need to spend a fortune on it. Small money will go a long way in these kind of things. And the same with calves, rearing calves. Like, these individual pens, for me, there are no for one-man operations and one-woman operations. You should have smaller pens. You can throw three or four of those freshly born calves. And look, they actually, it's much easier training them. They'll kind of learn off each other in terms of where the milk is when you're training them to the hangover, you know, the teat feeder to hang in the gate. There's a whole load of little things like that will actually add up to make a big difference. That's even before we looked at nighttime feeding, which is another option. Look, you need to be doing that for a few weeks for it to kick in, but those that do it, you know, find it very effective. The only downside to that is that you're probably busier in the morning, because your cows tend to calf from around 5 a.m. onwards if you're feeding them at nighttime at 8 or 9 o'clock. And, you know, that coincides with milking time, which isn't great if you're on your own. But I'd be more inclined to spend the money in getting better facilities in than do anything with calving pattern or calving rate.
Aidan, we touched off it in the quickfire, the kind of once-a-day milking for kind of February, I call it, you know, the kind of way, just for February, we'll say, and then switching back over to twice a day. I mean, it does definitely, you know, for a farmer of that scale, we'll say, like, it does free up kind of the guts of 2 hours in the day, you know, to kind of to be able to be around the yard, to look after the calves a bit better, et cetera, and that kind of thing. But it is going to impact on milk yield. There's no getting away from it.
Yeah, Jack, it's a great thing for February. It does impact the milk yield, but it's relatively small. I mean, cows, generally speaking, will milk about 20% less milk solids. Look, it's a little bit more in terms of the litres. It's about 25% or 30% in the litres for the period that they're on once a day, you know, presuming they're on once a day for about 4 weeks. But there's only going to be a very small few cows that will be on the once a day for that full 4 weeks. It's only the cows that are born or calve in the first week of February. Everything else is on 3 weeks, 2 weeks, or 1 week of once a days. And, you know, not all your cows calve in February either. So it's not a huge thing. Jack, it doesn't overcome the pinch points, which is March. You know, March is actually probably a busier month for most farmers than February, because they've all the, you know, nearly all the calves to feed. Cows tend to get problems in March. You know, if the weather is variable, you're trying to graze, you're in and out, you know, you've lime cubicles, you have to do, you know, you've an awful lot of stuff to do in March that you don't have to do in February. You're really only calving cows in February and milking cows. You have a lot of issues. Oh, look, I'm being flippant, you know, obviously you have to feed calves and all the rest, but March is kind of a trickier month for a lot of farmers. And the once a day doesn't really overcome that. For me, it's facilities and its system and it's being structured. And grazing is the key. You know, you can't overestimate the relief there is when cows can go out to grass, if even for a few hours to have the sheds empty. It gives you a chance to catch your breath, and you know, you don't have to go straight away from milking into liming cubicles into putting out silage, because the morning is gone in those situations.
Yeah, nice one. You have a nice piece this week in terms of your article in the journal, Aidan, in terms of looking forward for 2022. And I suppose you're the real hurler in the ditch. You're telling guys what they need to do. The couple of things, you've picked out a couple of things that they really need to do. Are they realistic, Aidan, or is it too unrealistic for a lot of farms to do what you're talking about there this week in that article?
Sure, I think it's realistic, Jack. You know, for the most part, the key one, really, the first one I have down is about making enough feed. And that's, you know, feeding the cows in terms of grazing, but also producing enough winter feed, because we really don't want a fodder deficit in spring 2023. That, for me, would be a disaster. We have an opportunity not to let that happen, provided farmers, you know, make sensible decisions around fertilizer use. And for me, that's a risk, because we know it's very expensive and we know farmers will balk at the cost of spending that money on fertilizer. But really, if your system is based around, you know, spreading fertilizer to grow that extra grass in order to carry those extra cows, really, you know, you've no choice but to go away and do it. Obviously, you can cut back in certain ways, and we've discussed that before, and we'll discuss it again around clover and slurry use and all the rest. But really, you still need to have a decision in your head that, you know, make a decision in your head that you're going to have to spread so much fertilizer in order to grow that feed. That's the first one. Meal cost then is another one. Jack, you know, you wouldn't believe it, but we've increased on average the amount of meal fed per cow by 40% since 2010. So the average now is around 1.2 tons of meal, whereas back then it was around 870 kilos, which is still a good bit higher than the Chagas target. Look, I'm not saying 500 kilos and no more, but you really need to look at where we're going in that way. There is definitely a lot of pressure on guys to produce more milk solids per cow. It's seen as being more profitable the more milk solids to produce. We know from data there is no actual correlation between profit and milk yield per cow. Yes, we all talk about it like it's the be all and end all, but it's not. And the easiest way to get high milk solids per cow is to feed more meal. I'm saying, look, we need to do a system check here. There's a lot of creep going into our costs, cost creep and system creep. Take a step back, look where we are. Meal costs are going up by 10% this month, I'm told. That's up, you know, they're up 20-30% already and where they were 12 months ago. So really, and a lot of the issue, Jack, is that, you know, we want to feed meal over the summer because it just makes life easier in terms of milking. Maybe there's employees milking now. And 5 or 10 years ago, the farmer and the fellas were doing a lot of the milking and they were happy to not feed meal and maybe, you know, encourage cows in themselves. It's a difficult to ask someone to come in and work on your farm and you're not going to feed meal for 6 or 8 weeks of the summer. And the meal feeders that we have, the batch feeders, they only have a minimum feed of 0.8 per kilo. So really you're stuck at 1.6 kilos of meal per cow per day in the summer if you're feeding morning and evening. And like, you know, there's no real value out of that. Like, you know, you're like, it's less than 10% of their overall diet. You're not getting much of a kick in terms of meat solids. It's definitely not covering the cost of it when you count in all the extra ancillary costs and you know, poor grass utilization and poor quality as a result. So I'd say that's something that we need to look at. That's one of the things. Energy costs, we've discussed that already as well, and in terms of the impact on fertilizer. But also, you know, electricity is a big cost, diesel is a big cost, and we tend to be using more and more consumption as tractors get bigger and machines are getting bigger and they're using more electricity. So a couple of things to look at there. And the other thing, I know I've talked about meal and milk solids, but keeping overall output up is also important. And the only the best way I see of keeping output up, and that's on top of milk solids now per cow, which is, as I said, there's no correlation between that and profit, but it's still important in terms of the overall output at the farm. Grass quality. Only 25% of farmers that are measuring grass and pasture base are going into covers of 1,400 at any one time. So, like, you know, 75% of farmers that are measuring grass, and they're the good farmers, Jack, that are measuring grass, are going in at the wrong covers. But the difference between grazing covers consistently at 1,300-1,400 versus 1,700-1,800 or 2,000, like a lot of farmers are, is huge in terms of milk solids per cow. And that difference is massive when you add it all up on a daily basis. So for me, that's a challenge I'm going to set to farmers, to go in at 1,400 this year rather than 1,700-1,800 or 1,900.
Keep on top. But Aidan, I think if they did three out of the four and with milk price where it is and the GDT up again this week, I think they could have a very prosperous 2022 for dairy farming. Thanks for that. Lads, earlier I had a chat with David Corbett from Grassland Agro. We had a chat about some of the things that we've talked about with Aidan in terms of fertilizer slurry. Let's have a listen. I don't know about where you are, but the slurry wheels are moving around us here in North Tipperary. It's good, dry, hard weather, we'll say. What's the story? Have you been out around the country?
All right, Jack, thanks for having me on. Jack, tankers flying all over the country. Look, slurry's going. To be fair, Jack, soil temperatures are good. They're probably up around 7 degrees. It is ideal for slurry. And look, one thing with slurry this time of year, there mightn't be the best efficiency out of it, but I know tanks are filling up. They probably have to be brought down a few foot, Jack. But look, soil temperatures are up. Ground conditions are good, and that is definitely positive.
Yeah, talking to a couple of the lads, as you say, around here, I mean, a lot of them, like in previous years, I will say, will have gone out with a lot more slurry. This is what they're telling me, that they've gone out with a lot more slurry at this time, but they're nearly holding off now, given the price of nitrogen, given kind of, I suppose, time of the year, obviously, and given, you know, they're nearly holding off on, like, they're taking it down a little bit, taking all the tanks down a little bit, is what they're saying. And again, the other piece, David, is they feel they're limited because there's a good bit of grass cover on a good bit of the milking platform at the moment. And even with trailing shoes, they're kind of slow to go in, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing, Jack, 100%. And look, it's probably one of the biggest problems, I'd say, this time of year, Jack. And especially this, I suppose, this January is we had such a mild spring, a lot of grass growth, and there are covers on farms, Jack. And look, I wouldn't be telling farmers to go with slurry on covers any more than 600, Jack. You know, it's trying to get graze out after that is going to be problematic. Look, the dribble bar is going to be a perfect option. Look, six to 1,000 cover, you'd probably be okay, Jack. But look, if you're going in a heavy application, you can lead to problems with graze outs in that, Jack. But what I would be advising farmers to do is, if they are thinking about going with slurry and they haven't gone with it yet, Jack, is to do a farm walk, see what kind of cover you have, and see where your covers are at. I suppose, targeting those lower covers with the slurry and look, Jack, holding back on that bag nitrogen. There's not much need for it, Jack. There's covers on farm. There's a lot of grass. I'd be saying even trying to graze out the heavier covers. Look, as soon as possible. Look, I know cows are starting to drop, Jack. But look, as soon as a bit of demand there, getting those heavier covers it out and getting slurry onto those bigger covers.
David, in terms of soil sampling, like it's an ideal time at this time of the year, we'll say, if things are still a little bit quiet on some of the dairy farms, as you say, calving just kicking off. I mean, in terms of getting soil samples done, I mean, for those paddocks, we'll say that you're putting out slurry on, and let's say they aren't soil sampled just yet, you know, and you're just not in a position to go at it. Like, when could you come back at them again for a soil sample? Like, when would you have to leave them for kind of a month, 2 months before you'd come back at them for a soil sample, you know, once you spread slurry on them?
You would, of course, Jack. You'd be talking 2 to 3 months even, Jack. Yeah, so look, if the slurry gone out, realistically, Jack, you're probably talking back in the next year, really. Because look, if the slurry gone out in silage ground, there might be a bit of compound going out there before it's closed up. And look, it's going to be getting P's and K's. If it's grazed, you're going to have nutrients recycled, so that's going to be offset, Jack. So look, I suppose ideally you'd just be leaving it off there till next year, Jack. But look, use your most recent soil samples. If 20-30% of the farm has got slurry, Jack, sample the rest of it. Sample that 70%, and we can come back to that 30%. Because look, Jack, information is going to be absolutely paramount there now this year. Knowing P and K levels on your farm, and variable spreading the slurry, Jack. And we don't need to know what the look, there's technology there now to link up with your fertilizer spreader and your tanker. You know, to variable spread your slurry or your compound, Jack. But we can do that just by taking the soil test results, Jack. And if we've high P's and K's, Jack, maybe if we can maybe go at 1,000 or 1,500 gallons, and maybe if we're at index ones or twos, we might be able to get out with that 2,500 gallons of slurry. And okay. I suppose varying it there that bit, Jack. But look, I suppose one thing as well, Jack, just on that and the soil as well is the temperature of the soil is going to be massive. And if you are going down doing a farm walk, look, a major player this springtime is going to be a soil thermometer. Try and get your hands on a soil thermometer, Jack. It's going to be a great indicator in how efficient the slurry or the bagging is going to be that goes on. And I actually seen a great piece there by John McCabe. He's a Chagas advisor. In Moore Park there, and he had a picture up there one day, and it was either side of a valley and a north and south facing field, and this was probably last Sunday morning, Jack, and it was the north facing field was covered in frost, and the south facing field had no frost of it, and this is about 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's just supposed to show, I suppose, the difference in soil temperature and the two fields looking at each other, do you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So as you say, the efficiency of nitrogen will be much better as the temperatures increase and you get better utilization, et cetera, and that kind of thing. And your other point in terms of the slurry, you know, keep the slurry for the low P and K paddocks, like we say, and put that on at your 2,000-2,500 gallons. The rest can do with a touch up at a thousand gallons to the acre or whatever in terms of slurry. Is there in terms of the nitrogen piece, David, is there much movement since, like, in terms of availability? And I suppose, again, there's some chat about protected urea, and some kind of, I suppose, people suggesting that it's not available and hence won't be used. I mean, talk to me about kind of the availability of protected nitrogen and kind of what's happening there in the market at the moment.
Yeah, look, Jack, I suppose one of the major stories there around the new year, Jack, was that 50 or 52% reduction in gas price, Jack. And look, it was down to, I suppose, that peak at Christmas. We saw a major peak just before Christmas, Jack, and I suppose it just came back down to, I suppose, where levels were, I suppose, that week before Christmas. So, look, gas prices are still high, and they're at the same level as they were when I suppose what fertilizer price was there before Christmas, Jack. But yeah, look, I suppose the supply is look, it is tight, Jack. Protected urea, I look at a lot of talk around if it's going to be available. I know a piece you done there last week yourselves, Jack, in the journal, just even that 2.8% increase in the use of protected urea. Look, it's great to see it, and great farmers are heading in that direction around ammonia emissions in that, Jack. And farmers want to go in that direction. And look, and a major I suppose player there too is the cost effectiveness of that protected urea and that urea source. But look, the supply is going to be there, Jack. It is going to be tight, but I suppose ourselves in Grass and Agro, we're, I suppose, committed to I suppose trying to fulfill that protected urea deficit and look trying to make it available. Look, there are supplies there, it is going to be tight, but I suppose we're trying to, I suppose, commit to make it available to farmers.
Okay. In terms of, I mean, it's a big job getting that first spin of nitrogen out, David. Do many guys actually bring in a contractor to do that first blanket spread, I call it? Like, you know, I mean, or do they tip away at it themselves? Or kind of, what do you see kind of as good practice going around from the good lads?
Yeah, well, look, Jack, it's probably the bigger lads that are the bigger, I suppose, are farmers that are getting in contractors, I suppose, to get the fertilizer spread. Look, to be fairly blunt about it, Jack, if a farmer was I suppose the fertilizer cost was 10,000 there last year, Jack, it's going to be probably a minimum of 25,000 this year. That's the way it is looking, 2.5 times the cost, Jack. So look, it's definitely something to think about, is getting in a contractor to spread that fertilizer, Jack. Getting the efficiency out of the fertilizer is going to be massive, Jack. And look, if you're not getting the contractor in, look, there's plenty of tools online, plenty of videos, steps into calibrating your spreader. Get a mechanic out from your local machinery depot, whoever you buy machinery off, and get the fertilizer spreader calibrated. And a major one, Jack, is just mounting the fertilizer spreader correctly. And I suppose mounting it and the forward speed, they're two major ones, Jack. But look, even around GPS, Jack, to be honest, I'd say a ton of can now this year would probably cover the cost of a GPS system for a tractor. So it could be the money well spent.
And David, you're saying the contractor, from the point of view that he'll have better equipment, he'll spread it better, he won't lose any, he won't be doubling over, etc. That's kind of where you're coming from, the contractor point of view. He'll do a better job of spreading it. Like, but at the same time, there is the piece, if the farmer is busy in the yard and there's calves popping out, etc., and that kind of thing, he's better placed there in the yard rather than out in the fields.
And look, and that's the thing, Jack, because just even think of this year now, in this spring, look, to be honest, Jack, there's going to be no, I don't think there'll be much nitrogen, if any nitrogen spread, until the middle of February. And look, in the years gone by, farmers have had it out there at the end of January before calving, and it's nearly an insurance policy. You know, it was out and it was a job done, and then they could concentrate on the calving, and that's not going to be the case this year, Jack. So, yeah look, getting the contractor in. I see we do a bit of work with a contractor down in Coastford there, the Cronins. Look, the technology they have on the tractor and the precision, on the spread. And look, and every other contractor there, I suppose contractors have to step up to the plate now, and they are, you know, the technology they have and the gear is fantastic, Jack.
Yeah, no, it's their job. Let them do it well, and let them at it. And they have the time and the machinery to dedicate to it.
The thing, Jack. But even Jack on the spreader there, you know, the farmer, look, fertilizer was cheap, and farmers would be going with the spinner and going to fertilizer, and the I suppose a good day of spreading fertilizer was when you come back to the yard and there was nothing left in the spinner, you know, Jack. And look, a massive one as well, Jack, is if a farmer can take an evening, just spend a few hours and actually set in stone what the paddock sizes are, or get the farm mat, and that's going to be a massive one, Jack, just in getting the rates right, be it the slurry or the fertilizer, getting that right, Jack. Because look, I see it. I see it myself at home. Like, you know, you do that victory lap around the paddock there, just to you put her into three high there, and you do a lap around the field just to get the spinner empty, you know. Look, we I suppose we need to be going away from that and be more precise in the application.
Right, folks, very interesting. Thanks to David Corbett from Grassland Agro for taking our call. Right, that's it for another week. Thanks for watching, and indeed, thanks for listening. Thanks to all our own specialists, Aidan, Adam and Darren. If you want more from Farmers Journal podcasts or webinars, go to ifj.ie/podcast/webinars. We'll be back again next week. Until then, stay safe and safe farming.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.